This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Campbell Mattinson, welcome to Better Reading.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, wow. It's a great biography, and I'm going to read it right now, your introduction, that you started as a journalist and you had a cadetship in 1997. Campbell worked as a writer, editor, photographer, and wine critic. I mean, they're all pretty much, except reading, they're all the things that I love in life.
Yeah, it's fair to say I've spent my life doing things I enjoy.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same, particularly interested in your story. He has also had stints as a dishwasher in an Indian restaurant, as a data clerk at a stockbroker, and a proofreader of phone books. Now, that would have been the hardest job, I'd say.
Yes, the proofread of phone books. I'm glad you picked up on that, actually, because I just think it's the funniest thing. But yeah, if a phone number is wrong, that was termed a critical error.
Yeah. I remember this is years and years ago. My sister worked in at a legal practice, and she had some business cards printed for her boss. And that was back then where business cards were so important. And she printed her phone number rather than his and her home number. Oh, my God. She would have needed a proofreader. Anyway, Campbell has also won the Best Australian Sports Writing Award in 1996. For a story that is the basis of We Were Not Men. And that's the book that we're talking about today. He's also written a 2006 biography of winemaker Maurice O'Shea called The Wine Hunter, and that has won numerous awards. I mean, you obviously have been writing for a very long time. He describes his new novel and his debut novel, We Were Not Men, as the only story I ever really wanted to write. Wow. Okay, so we're going to come to how you wrote that. Firstly, I want to go back to where the love of writing started. Where did you grow up, and at what point did you know that you were going to be a writer?
Yeah, I grew up in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and where I came from was, you know, and it's referenced in the book in terms of, you know, we looked out the front window of our house almost, you know, pretty much literally at the oil refinery, and that area. It was a very characterful area. It was always really important to me. But you know, the urge to write, I don't know, it's not something you ever decide on. I can't remember a time when I didn't want to write. There was a moment, I was either in grade five or grade six, so, you know, I was 10 or 11 years old, I guess, when I was accused of plagiarism. And I remember sitting there by a teacher, and I remember sitting there, and I don't think I actually said anything. I don't think I even denied it. Just the fact that somebody thought that was from a book and I knew that I'd written it, it was the best encouragement you could ever get, I think, for a kid.
It has to be one of the greatest compliments, doesn't it? So she accused you, or he accused you of plagiarism because it was so well written that you possibly could not have written it.
Yeah. It was because they just didn't think that was an 11-year-old's writing.
Wow, isn't that extraordinary? Isn't that extraordinary? It wasn't that, you know, it was a paragraph out of, you know, Lord of the Flies or anything like that. That would have been familiar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So,
did you feel that as writing as a child that was what you were going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was always just a matter of, what does that look like in terms of, you know, how do you make a living out of that? Like, I always just wanted to write stories and fiction, but I was, you know, aware that was probably going to mean journalism. And so it was, how do I get into journalism from there?
Mm. And were you a great reader?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I, I always look back and think how lucky I was with the teachers who recognised what it was that I was into or what I wanted to do and just let me do it. Mm. In terms of, you know, I had teachers who just went right from the end of primary school onwards, look, if you just want to sit and read books, which is all I want us to do, they just let me read books in class.
You know, and, because it's not a bad activity to
yeah, read. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So even I remember in HSE English, the English teacher said, I said to her, look, I think that this class is kind of a waste of time. Do you mind if I just go to the library? And she went, sure. You know? So I spent all of year 12 at the library reading.
Mm. What do you think are some of the early influences?
As in writers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot of it, to be honest. I remember Ivan Southall and the spooky thing about the fact that, you know, he was the first author, other than things like Storm Boy, mm. He was the first author that really, really captured me. And the spooky thing is that's from literally 40 years ago. Just recently I mentioned Ivan Southall to my mother-in-law and she said that he actually lived on the property that my wife grew up on.
Oh, wow.
And I only learnt that 2 weeks ago and we've been married over 20 years. So this writer who influenced me 40 years ago, it turns out he lived on the same farm. They lived on a farm. He had a house on the edge of the farm.
Wow.
Bear farm.
Yeah, so you were destined. I just looked him up and Hill's End is one of the books that comes up. Josh is another. He's not somebody I'm all that familiar with. So then you went to high school. Sometimes I find the passion for reading and writing gets quashed in high school and mainly for boys. I'm not quite sure why. Did that happen to you?
Yeah, not at all.
Oh, good.
And but that said, in both year 11 and 12, I was the only boy in literature.
Yeah. Yeah, it does for a reason, doesn't it? They pick it up back at university but seem to give it up a little bit in high school.
Not at all. In
not
fact,
for you.
Yeah, no, it just got ramped up further.
Yeah. And is that because you were reading more?
Yeah, I guess it's a matter of finding the right books. I mean, there's so many, the state the bleeding obvious, there's so many different types of books. There's a book for everybody.
Yeah,
and I guess I was just coming across the right books.
And you had the right teachers and the right people around.
I did have the right teachers and I just felt like I was blessed all through high school in terms of, you know, well, I had a couple of great teachers for 2 years each, but, you know, I didn't have a bad English teacher. And they were the kind of teachers who brought books to life. So, yeah.
Mm. So you then decided you wanted to be a journalist. Is that right?
I did, yes. Well, I thought that was the best path forward for somebody who wanted to write. And interestingly, my careers teacher said, you know, you're not going to get into journalism. It's too hard. And so I actually, straight out of high school, didn't even attempt to get into journalism. And because I took that advice literally that it was too hard to get into. And I met the editor of the local paper very late in the night with both of us quite a bit to drink and I got a cadetship out of it.
Oh, wow. I want to go back to that, but I just want to touch a little bit on careers counsellors. They didn't exist when I was at school, so I'm older than you. However, in the 200-odd podcasts that I've been recording for the last couple of years and speaking to writers, not one of them has ever said, oh, and I had a great careers counsellor that said you should pursue your writing.
Yeah.
A lot of people have said they've had great teachers, particularly English teachers,
yeah,
but career counsellors seem to dissuade people from their passion.
It's crazy.
Yeah, if you're a careers counsellor out there, write to me and let me know why. But, you know, that does seem to happen. So cadetships are fantastic, aren't they, for journalists?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly I was at a suburban paper and then at a country, well, out of suburban country fringe, and you just get thrown in at the deep end and it's got its downsides, but they're terrific. They're terrific.
Yeah, and I guess too, I mean, it makes perfect sense learning on the job with writing because, you know, you're writing, you have to write a couple of stories, you know, probably a day or, you know, in a week.
Yeah.
And so that's the practice of writing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm not quite sure what it's like these days. I mean, I know that the demands on local journalists are so much greater, but the kind of depth of experience that we had around us, because it was a proper news team, even though it was just a local paper, in that there was, you know, the sub-editor was, you know, had been in the game for 40 years and had been at dailies, and you know, the casual sub was the same, and you had a hierarchy of A grade, B grade, C grade journalists. And so for first year cadet to walk into that, you just had so much to be inspired by, but just, you know, like, I've still got those people sitting on my shoulder now in terms of, you know, I hear the things that they used to say, don't do this, look out for this, and it still rings.
Yeah, no, fantastic experience, isn't it? So I want to know then how you got to be a wine critic, because if there's something that I'm crazy about in life, and that outside of books, it's and food, I guess. But let's talk about wine. How did you step into that?
Yeah, look, I realised pretty early on in journalism that I was better suited to freelance than to staff. And so I went out on my own, and it's a fairly tough road for a freelancer, and it certainly was back then. It's probably got a little bit easier. I got interested in wine and thought that I'd pitched an article on wine, which I did, and which was picked up. And then I literally didn't pitch another article for over a decade, because all the work just came to me. There was just a lot of work in wine. And so I never made the decision to be a wine writer. I never called myself a wine expert, even though that's technically what I've done for the last 20 years. So it was an accidental career, but it's been a wonderful career for me.
But aren't so many careers accidental?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And this was, I mean, it's not accidental in the journalism side of it, but just that I'd focus on the one topic.
Mm. So do you get sent beautiful wine almost every day?
I do. And whilst that sounds great, it's fairly hard work physically, just being around alcohol all the time, all the time. I was captured by wine, or captivated by wine, because of the landscape aspect of it, the people working the landscape and their interaction with the landscape. I mean, the higher you go up the wine hierarchy, the more it becomes about the specific patch of land. And so I always found that fascinating, but most of my jobs actually is just opening bottles.
It is interesting, because I think I don't think about wine that much. It's not my career, but when I do open a bottle of wine these days, and I think it, for me, it has been a maturity thing, it's the complex of the smell, the complex of the taste. But very often now it takes me back to moments, to places like reading does, where I've had that taste. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, funny you should say that, because the thing that actually really clicked me over to wine is I'd grown up on this property at Flowerdale my grandparents had, which features in the book. And that property had been sold. And so I kind of had this really both an emotional attachment to that property, but it was lost. It was lost to me. And 15 years after that property, you know, we stopped being able to go to that property, I picked up this wine at a work event and wasn't thinking anything of it. I was just, you know, 9 o'clock at a work function on a Tuesday night. And I picked up this wine and I just smelt at it casually. And as soon as I smelt at that wine, I thought, it smells like Flowerdale. It smells like that property that I miss. Mm-hmm. And now that I know more about wine, there's probably a, you know, not so romantic reason. I mean, that wine was from the general vicinity. So, you know, I didn't know that at the time, but I then went and researched it, and they were both from the, you know, that property was Yarra Valley Fringe and that wine was Yarra Valley. So, but it was probably just that it was grown in an area, that wine was grown in an area that had similar gum trees growing there, and I was smelling the gum trees.
Yeah, it's interesting how people always talk about, you know, books and coffee or books and wine. And, you know, I've, beyond preparing to talk to you today, I knew that there was a connection, but the connection is deeper. There is story in smell and taste, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and one of the things you're trying to do is get, it's very difficult to describe. They're not the easiest things to describe. I spend my whole life trying to describe them, because it's as much trying to evoke those things as it is trying to actually nail them.
Mm.
What impression do those things have on you?
Mm. I look at a kind of a biography or a career or a CV or whatever you want to call it of someone like you, and I wonder, you know, when I'm doing my prep, why did it take you so long to write? But when you think about it, it's stories have to come from living, don't they? I mean, you can't write the greatest Australian novel just out of high school or just out of university. There has to be a life behind it, an experience, observation. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's something I've had a long time to think about.
Mm. And a long time to live, you know?
Yeah. And look, you know, particularly in this book centres around two boys who've had a really, really tragic thing happen to them. You know, there's a lot of hurt in this book. My life experience is nothing like the life experience of these boys. But trying to write a story over decades, it just hurt more and more and more that I couldn't get this book, this story to where I wanted it to go. And so I felt like I came, you know, I'm dealing with fictional characters, but I came closer and closer to them over the years. And I think that that made it an immeasurably better book. And that if I'd somehow, I started trying to write this book when I was in, you know, my mid-ish 20s, or maybe even younger than that, it couldn't possibly be anywhere near as good, no matter how good I was or wasn't back then. Like it's something I hesitate to say this publicly, but every now and then I read a book that's fantastic and think to myself, as good as that book is, it would be even better if that writer was 10 years older.
Mm.
Sometimes, you know, with books, sometimes it's not a rush.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But I think that sometimes with life, it's not a rush. Like I think that a lot. People often, you know, comment on my career. Oh, you're so lucky you're in a job that you love. You know, you're so lucky you've got a business that you love. But in a way, I couldn't have gotten here without all those other jobs.
Yeah.
There's no way I could have had this job 20 years ago. Because I wouldn't have had the experience, the observation, the reading, the skill, all of it. You just don't have it, do you?
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a really interesting topic, actually.
I get fascinated with authors and aging. Like, you know, when I read, like, say, Peter Carey or Ian McEwan, or I've read so much of those writers, and in their fictional story, I see them aging. Do you notice that about reading?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, this is a little bit off topic, but writers often talk about how writing's a muscle and you must practice it every day. And that is absolutely true. It couldn't be truer. But it's not the whole truth. I actually think that's important for writers, you know, to use an agricultural phrase, to lie fallow. I think there's time when you shouldn't write. And you know, through my journey, I went through a long period where getting the perfect sentence was kind of the whole game. And then I had a gap where I went, look, you know, certain things aren't, you know, I I got off that treadmill of just writing every day all the time. And I started to realize that whether or not the sentence is perfect, oh, that's just a given. You know, if you're heading for publishing, the fact that you can write good sentences, that's just a starting line. That's kind of, nobody really cares about that. You've got to, you know how to tell a story, and you've got to know how to build character, and, you know, there's all these other things that are the real game.
Mm. I've spoken about this before on this podcast. I am one of those people, and I think I'm a dream reader for, say, a writer, and I'm a dream watcher of TV or a watcher of movies or whatever, because for some reason my brain, like when I'm watching a movie and I'm petrified or somebody gets shot, I don't think about cameras. Like people say to me, oh, you know, and that, of course, that wasn't true. No. It's always true for me. I can't remove the craft from the story. I am in it 150%. And it's the same with reading. I might not love it, but I can't see anything else other than what the story you're telling me.
Yeah, that's right. And the better you get at the craft and the better you get at the storytelling, and it may well have taken you know, years to get it to this point, but it looks effortless, you know, and it's that effortlessness that takes an enormous amount of effort and an enormous amount of kind of just development of your craft.
I remember when I first spoke to Tim Winton, I'd been itching to speak to Tim Winton for years. I've read just about everything he's written. And if I lived in WA, I'd probably be stalking him. I'm that kind of a fan.
Well, it's funny you should say that, but and sorry to interrupt, but one of my first ever freelance articles was along the lines of stalking Tim Winton. It's like I travelled to WA just hoping to see him. I just thought that he'd be, you know. And funnily enough, I actually did see him in Fremantle, which was, what were the chances? No, I didn't.
Hey, and so you wrote that?
Yeah, so it was called Winton Spotting.
Are you going to send me that?
That's going back to the mid-90s. Oh, okay. I wouldn't even have it, but yeah.
Oh, well, what a shame. Let me just tell you a little bit about stalking. I lived in the UK in London for a while, and I was on a bus and I saw Elvis Costello. Right. And I was mad on Elvis, right? Mad. I still am, actually. And I couldn't believe it. So when he got off the bus, I got off the bus and I just followed him, right? And then I followed him home. He must have known I was there. I know I was like, you know, maybe 20. And then when he got to his house and he walked in, I thought, so what do I do now? And then I just walked away. Like, what was the point of that, Cheryl? You know? It was such a futile exercise. And I think in a way his body language felt that as well. Like, you know, what's she going to do once I get home? Nothing. You know, I haven't stalked anyone since because I realised it's kind of a dead end. But anyway, getting back to Tim Winton. So Tim Winton, he had been hard to track down and somebody to speak to. And when I finally got a podcast with Tim Winton, you can imagine how excited I was. And it was in person. It was pre-COVID. So he came into our office. When he started to talk about craft, he then told me how many times he rewrites a sentence or he rewrites a page. And then when he delivers it, then it's the editorial process and all the rewriting. And for some reason, with all my experience, with everything, because this is only like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it wasn't that long ago, so I should have known better, I was so surprised that it didn't all just come out that way.
Yeah.
What? And I think it's because it reads that way.
Yeah, absolutely, which is what we're all striving for. Yeah, I actually remember going back to writing school, an editor came and spoke to us and she was talking about how she'd copy edited Helen Garner and what an experience that was, and it took her a long time to dare to move a word.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't think that it would have been I think she would have been slightly prickly as well, I guess. Although one of my favourite books is The First Stone. Oh, and Joe Cinque's Consolation.
Yeah, they're great books.
Aren't they great books?
Yeah.
Great books. I've got to say I'm probably more of the non-fiction fan than the fiction. But anyway, what a beautiful
book. Yeah, look, I generally say that, but I still love Monkey Grip. I think that Monkey Grip is great. I've gone back to it a couple of times and I still love it. Mm. And I read Jacqueline Maley's latest book and thought, And it made me think of Monkey Grip. It like, couldn't be more different. But at the same time, there's just by the by, Jacqueline Bailey is a force.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll take note of that. I remember when I read Jo Cinque, I didn't realise that there was a photograph of him at the end of the book. And also, I'm not a person that reads the last page. Or I know people do that. I don't do that. I'm really from beginning to end, and that's how I run it. And I remember when I finished and then I saw his photo and it really just, you know, tiny little photo. It was like a passport size photo. And it just added to that great story. It's really well done. Now, talk to me about We Were Not Men. You'd been working on it for years. My curiosity around books like this is, at what point do you think it's finished?
And in some ways, I mean, it is finished, obviously, but because I've been able to tinker with it for so long, I'm still tinkering with it in my head just a little bit.
Yeah, wow.
Because I'm so used to just seeing and reading and listening and you know, just having those thoughts. And the story of the story is that, you know, and it's going back a hell of a long time, but somebody who was important to me died tragically and, you know, in a way that just hit all of us.
How old were you when that happened?
It was 1990, so I guess I was 22.
That's formative, right?
Yeah. And now that I've come out and started talking about this, about how much this guy's death affected me, because I just had an outpouring, not of his story, but a story that bounced directly off his story. It's been incredible how many people have come to me in the last few weeks and said, yeah, I still think about him all the time too. And somebody said, yep, there's a kind of video tribute to that guy. And somebody said, I watch it every month. And it's 30 years later. Isn't that incredible?
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. So I bounced straight off that. I just had this outpouring and wrote, he was good at sport and he was a twin and he died on a river. And I poured my heart into this story that was about twins who were good at sport, who spent a lot of their life were on a creek, but, you know, in the water. And so it was directly, you know, inspired by that. And I had a book, I reckon in 9 months, and actually had printed it out and got an envelope and addressed it. And I was going to send it to wherever I was going to send it to. And I just went, I probably should read it through one more time. And then I just realised that I had these twin boys, you know, their story was quite simple but clear and I was happy with the storyline, but they go to live with their grandmother and I just didn't think she added enough, and that was the start of a very long journey.
Well, I tell you what, Campbell, it's well worth it. It really is a beautiful book. It's called We Were Not Men. It's out now. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.